on ABC Radio.
This is The Big Fish
with Scott Levi.
Ahoy there, welcome aboard another episode of The Fish, and Stinker's back in the saddle. After his horrendous run of form, we head to the river with Peachy for a check nymphing masterclass on the last weekend of the trout season. And Craig McGill is back from an adventure on the Coffs Coast, where things didn't go to plan. But he's still caught a few and discovered something that we'll share with you, which will up your crab catch dramatically. It's all coming up on The Big Fish. It's The Big Fish, and I always chuckle to myself when we catch up with some of our great fish shows who do it for a living. Craig McGill is a professional fishing guide, so just about every working day of his life he's out on Sydney Harbour teaching people how to fish, looking after people, giving them a great time. It's such a great place because you see the Opera House and the bridge and the most beautiful harbour city in the world, and you catch some great fish as well. So he's a tour guide and a fishing guide and just an all-round top bloke. But when he has a holiday, you would think the furthest thing from his mind would be catching fish. But guess what, Big Fish listeners? He goes on a fishing holiday. He's just back from 4 weeks in Coffs Harbour. Admittedly, 3 weeks of it was rain, but that's what you do, Craig.
Yeah, mate, I'm a rain magnet now. Every time I go away, it rains. We had a trip last year sometime, and it rained for 3/4 of the time, and that happened this time too. I've got to get a break soon, I think.
Well, the farmers will love you. They'll be inviting you out to the southwest of the state and the central west. Say, so come and fish.
I should start selling my services, my rain magnet services.
Come and fish for our cod. And you like the estuaries too, and I know you'll fish bait in the harbour, but you're luring soft plastic and things only, sports fishing only. Which estuaries did you fish around the Coffs Coast?
So my main target, my main reason for going there is I've become a bit obsessed with mangrove jacks. I've caught heaps of mangrove jacks all up through the top end, but they're pretty easy up in the Territory and Queensland and that. But for some reason, those northern New South Wales ones, well, one, they're much bigger mangrove jacks, and they're much harder to catch. I don't know why. So anyway, we're hitting all those little estuaries up there, Coffs Creek, Bonville, Pine, Boambi, the Bellinger, the Kallang. I'm giving myself 20 years to catch one.
How to work it out. I was watching a kid on YouTube in a kayak the other day fishing around the Tweed and Gold Coast canals, and he hooked a couple of thumpers, real horses. You know, they're big ones in our estuaries compared to up north, aren't they?
Oh, they are, mate. Look, I was diving, well, snorkeling under one of the little bridges at the mouth of one of the creeks there at Coffs, and the jacks just amaze me. Like, I swam out there expecting to, you know, see a couple of jacks around the pylons, maybe one or two, but there's schools of 40 and 50 of these things, and some of the ones near the bottom were getting up to sort of 6-7 pound fish, you know. I felt like I'd swam out to the solitary islands or something and dived down. It was hard to believe. I actually think that those creeks up there have got a lot more jacks in them than people think. I just think they're hard. They're just really hard to catch.
Do you think they're more night feeders, Craig?
I actually think that they're quite similar to dewies. I think they like feeding at night. I think they're very tide-based. I think they like that turn of the tide. I think they get up over the flats at nighttime. I'm making it much harder for myself by chasing them with lures, and I like daytime fishing. I'm pretty sure if I wanted to get a jack, I'd go and get a big mullet or a herring and flick it into the snags around the pylons. I'd probably get one pretty quickly, but, you know, I want to do it the hard way. I've set a bit of a challenge, but I'll get them. When I was a kid, my grandfather lived on Boambi Creek, and there was a couple of guys that used to go paddling. Two guys that have four guys that have two canoes, And they'd paddle down Boambi and they'd come back up to where my grandfather's house was, and that's where they launched. And I remember my granddad telling me that they always had these, he used to call them red bass, but he said these big red bass in the bottom of their canoes. And I saw them one day as a kid and I was just mesmerized by them. And funny coincidence, one of the guys gave my granddad one of the lures that he'd been catching them on, because my granddad had been asking a lot of questions, and they said, here, take this lure and give it a go. It was an old Rebel, I can't remember what it was now, but one of those old minnows that had the three sets of trebles. Anyway, years and years later, I was talking to Terry Dunphy, John Dunphy's brother, at one of the tackle or boat shows, and I was telling him this story, and he said, you know, me and my mates used to put our canoes in and go down there. I said, do you ever remember giving an old geezer one of your lures back at the launch? He said, yeah, Harry, I remember giving him one of the lures. That was my granddad, and it was Terry Dunphy that gave him the lure, and I found out like 35 years later that it was him.
And, wow. That's a family that made such a contribution to fishing in Australia too, in bringing in good and affordable tackle and getting right behind the soft plastic revolution and Bushy and Starlow and Rexy and the catch and release revolution and looking after lots of fisher folks. They really are well respected in the fishing. Well, we're speaking with Craig McGill, who's just back from a Coffs Coast jack attack, or was it? How many did you get?
No, mate, look, to be honest, this trip was a bit of a disaster. It was a washout. We got 3 weeks of rain out of 4 weeks and quite heavy, persistent rain too. So it sort of just ruined it. And a little bit out of season too. I know they do get the jacks all year there, but if you want to get them, you really got to go up there sort of, November through till March probably. And that's the problem, because that's my busy season here in Sydney. I've never really had a chance to properly hit like peak season up there, but that's my retirement plan. But if the jacks don't send me insane before that happens and I end up in an asylum or something, but that's my plan.
Well, the other thing they do is come out from the snag, very snag oriented in the daytime. As you say, they probably range around through the estuary like Mulloway and feed up on everything in the nighttime. But they come out from the snag and then they get a full head of steam up and hit your lure or soft plastic or fly or whatever and head straight back for home. And that's the thing that I think catches a lot of people out. You've got to have stout enough tackle to withstand that first onslaught, because so many people just smash and grab, you know, bang, boom, snap, ping. Oh, no, I've been dusted up by something huge. And that's their tactic. So once you get them turned, you know, they do fight hard, but once you sort of weather that initial onslaught, you can get them.
Yeah. Yeah, no, they are. They're brutal in that first few seconds. And I'm fishing 30 main and 30 leader. And it's always a compromise with that stuff because, you know, the heavier that you go, the less bites you get. And of course, everything up there that you're casting to, especially around the bridge pylons and the man-made structure, is all covered in oysters and barnacles. So they've only got to brush up against it and you're gone even on 30. And there's a bit of luck in it. Look, it's like kingies or anything, you know. Kingies will go for the bottom too, but sometimes they'll swim out wide and make a mistake. They'll go away from the rocks or away from the structure. And jacks do the same thing. I've caught lots of them up north, smaller ones. But yeah, like you say, if you can weather that first 10 seconds, you're probably going to get them.
Yeah, and seeing so many fish, that's not a bad theory that they might hold up under the bridges or in the snags and then do their feeding at night and, you know, have a rest through the day. That makes a bit of sense. But you would have caught something. I mean, the weather conditions were woeful, but I believe you turned your attention to mud crabbing in those creeks.
Yeah, I did. I had plenty of time on my hands, so I thought I'm going to go and get a few traps, and found out something interesting, actually. I've crabbed all my life, and for the last 30 or 40 years, I've had pretty much the same traps that have held up. And
are they the ones with the orange mesh?
The orange mesh, yeah. So your standard round collapsible trap, it's sort of got four conical-shaped entrances. And I've always done okay. I've always got a crab here and there, you know, enough for a feed. But I lost one of my traps. Well, I didn't lose it. It sort of just deteriorated. And I thought I'd go down to May's Tackle there at Coffs and get a new one. And I was looking through them and I found one that was very similar to what I had, but it had black mesh rather than the orange mesh. And so I put the two out. I put the black one out and the orange one. And by day three, I hadn't caught a thing in the orange one. I'd caught all the crabs. I had 11 crabs over 3 or 4 days, and they were all in the black one. Plus fish, there was estuary cod had gone in there and brim and other things, all of which I let go.
You're not allowed to keep them when you trap them in New South Wales, are you? I think it might be different in Queensland. I'm not sure, but any fish you catch, you've got to let them out.
Well, that's right, yeah. Well, I mean, estuary cod are protected in New South Wales anyway, so they had to go back, as delicious as they are. But, yeah, I don't think you're allowed to keep a fish, any fish that you catch in a crab trap. But, yeah, so I went and bought another black trap. So then I was running two, pretty much side by side, same bait, only 10 metres apart. And then started getting fish and crabs in both traps, and basically the orange ones. Well, my orange traps are going to be on the next council collection out in the street if anybody wants them.
I wonder what the reasoning was behind having the orange mesh. So there, you can see them under the water perhaps, because I know you don't want to be running into them and things in an estuary with the prop. I'm not sure why the orange. It sounds like you've found that they have a bit of an aversion to it. What's your theory as to why the black mesh worked better than the orange?
Well, yeah, I mean, for starters, just as a side issue, getting your traps pinched up there is a big problem, right? So, and that's the other thing I found with the black traps. I haven't got them in real deep water, and you know, the orange ones sort of stand out at low tide. So it sort of helps stop getting them nicked as well, because they're a lot less visible. But I just think if you look at mud crabs, that you know they'll bury in during the day, and they'll either be in the black mud or the black mangrove roots. And I just think that you know, they don't want to go onto a background that's going to make them stand out, you know, just for their own sort of safety. So I think it's got a lot to do with that, to be honest.
Yeah, right. They're very, very interesting indeed. But the results, even though it was a small survey sample, it sounds like you've hit on a bit of a thing there. You won't be using the orange ones anymore by the sound of it.
No, they'll be on council cleanup next time. But the black one, like, having seen what I saw on this trip, there's no way I'd be running the orange ones again.
Is mullet your favorite bait, or what do you like to pop in? Because there's all sorts of weird and wonderful theories about mud crab bait, aren't there? Chicken and steak, yeah, and liver and all this other stuff.
I think they'll eat pretty much anything, but two things I've found. They do tend to prefer the oily fish. So mullet, I was running bonito frames that I actually bought up with me from Sydney. They do seem to like the oily fish, but the other thing that's a myth is that, you know, the old timers used to say that they'd leave their crab bait out in the sun for 2 days and get it stinking. That's not true. That doesn't work. I find fresh bait in crab traps increases your catch dramatically.
Yeah, I'd really agree with you. I do a lot of line fishing for blue swimmers, because traps of any type aren't allowed in my estuary. And the fresher the mullet, you know, if you can get it from the fish shop when they've netted them, you know, haven't been frozen, even better. The frozen stuff will work, but yes, fresh stuff for sure seems to be the go. We're speaking with Craig McGill, professional fishing guide, who's just been back not long from holidays in Coffs Harbour. You would have caught a few fish, though, surely, after 4 weeks. I know you know what you're doing. I mean, conditions weren't great, but you would have boated a few.
Oh, mate, when the sun finally came out in that last week, I was just stoked. And I've got a friend that lives at Bellingen. So he's a very keen fisher. So we
that's Kendall Kramer country.
Yeah, that's right, the Bellinger River. So we put in there, and we did 3 or 4 days on the Bellinger and a couple on the Kallang.
That's beautiful, isn't it? It was so beautiful. I love that front end of the estuary around Urunga and those gorgeous sand flats and drop-offs. It's just so fishy. It's got everything, hasn't it?
Oh, mate, look, that's – That area there's quite amazing, actually. It's a temperamental system because it comes out of those mountains up the back, particularly the Bellinger. It picks up that cold water out of the hills pretty quickly, so it can switch on and off. But the variety of stuff they get up there is amazing. You know, everything from your southern species, flathead, brim, whiting, blackfish, right through to, you know, jacks, estuary cod, GTs, tarpon, giant herring. My mate Pete just picks up everything there. But we had good sessions pretty much every time we went out. We had good sessions. We got plenty of bass, some good size bass up to 45 centimetres.
Any still on the surface?
I got one on the surface, yep. Early morning, one morning. It was still quite warm up there, actually. It hasn't really cooled down like it has here yet. But lots of flatties, lots of brim. My mate Pete got a blackfish on a lure.
That's a great effort. Was it a big one?
Yeah, it was a good one, which you don't see a lot. I have heard of it before, but it's not overly common. We got some estuary cod. It's just good all-round fishing there. And it's such a beautiful, like you say, the scenery there. You could fish all day and catch nothing and still enjoy it. And the other good thing, too, is they've been working on that Yerungan boardwalk for a long, long time now, many years, and that's finally open. So that's a great walk if you're up there as a tourist or fishing or whatever. That's worth a look.
Is that around the foreshore at Yerunga, is it?
That's right. So it runs from the caravan park at Yerunga, right down along the breakwall, basically to the sea.
Oh, that's good, because you were a little bit, access wasn't great there. You were a little bit isolated there. My grandparents used to stay there because my grandfather's great fisherman, and when he was older, he'd just walk out of a little flat they had straight onto the sand flats and catch a flathead or a whiting and just loved it. And I never forget when I was a little kid, they put a mum and dad said, well, you're going to your grandparents, they're at Yerunga. So they put me on the overnight train and they put a tag on me, you know, like a pinned a note to me.
Said, yeah.
This is Scott Levi and he's going to his grandparents at Yerunga. Sat me on the train with my little bag. Off you go.
They've tagged you like a crab trap.
Yeah.
Your name and address. And
the property of the Levi family. Please make sure he gets to his Nana and Da.
Yeah.
We had a great time.
Look, I used to do a very similar thing. My parents used to put me on the train and I'd go to Sawtelle where my granddad was. Very, very similar situation.
It's a good spot. It's a good spot too. You go to all the good spots. You, a few years back, you had a great holiday on the Shoalhaven too and caught the biggest estuary perch I'd ever seen.
Yeah. No, well, my brother, he's down there at Shoalhaven Heads now, so I spend quite a bit of time down there. That's a remarkable fishery, given that it's still commercially fished. The Shoalhaven's quite a remarkable spot, really.
Is the Kallang and the Bellinger still commercially fished?
No. They were part of that buyout many years ago when the licences first came in.
And have you seen it bounce back, get better?
Oh, definitely, yeah. Yeah, that used to get hit pretty hard, actually.
So you caught EPs in the Bellinger as well. They've got a big range, haven't they? They've got a phenomenal range. I wonder how far north they do get, because they're very, very prolific here where I live, just north of Sydney. They're pretty cryptic. You know, they either turn up, you either find 100 or none.
Yeah, well, I can tell you, because my mate Pete, while we were there last week, got an EP. And we were talking about their range, so I Googled it. They reckon the Richmond River at Ballina is the northern extent, and then they get them right down into Tassie. So they're sort of...
We had a story about the secret EPs of Tassie. They should really be protecting those. They're in the Arthurs River, and that's it. And they're big and old and black in that tannin-stained water, and they're the last viable population. So the fisheries down there are just working out how to... They're totally protected. You can't catch them, but how to enhance them? Because I was thinking, you know, I know it's a great trout fishery, but boy, if they started to breed up those Tasmanian EPs and put them into those big estuaries and big harbours and rivers they have, that would be the greatest sports fishery in the world, because they're just an amazing fish.
They are, and they certainly don't mind the cold water. I think. They're just the southern equivalent of bass, really, and there's quite a big overlap in the middle, but they seem to be more prolific the further south you go, and vice versa with the bass when you're heading north.
and so hardy. I mean, for them to live right down in the southwest of Tasmania and all the way up to the Bellinger River, that's a pretty phenomenal range and temperature range. When it comes to water, they're a great fish. We're really lucky to have them. And boy, they're a great sports fish, aren't they? A good eating fish too. A wonderful all-round fish. And just very movement-oriented. You can't catch them on a dead bait. They've got to take a lure or a soft plastic or a fly. They're very much like the jacks, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah, they are actually.
Without the big teeth.
They live in the snags. They've got that big nighttime eye. They like the shadows. They love the shadows. When you go looking for them, you're not necessarily looking for the big log snags, but you're looking for the overhanging trees that have still got the leaves of them that cast the big shadow. And jacks are quite similar to that. They love the shade. I think they're just a nighttime fish that's keeping out of the sun in the daytime, and they just sit still. And if you get the right time and get the lure in the right spot in the shadows, you'll get the odd one every now and then.
You catch any dewies?
A couple of small sapies. In fact, I pulled out a 40-year-old wonder wobbler out of my tackle box and flicked
it. A wonder wobbler. Wow.
A wonder wobbler.
That was the first lure I caught a flathead on, the wonder wobbler.
Yeah, well, this was one of the old original ones. I pulled it out and I thought I got to be really careful with this because I don't want to lose it. And got a dewey under the Kallang Road Bridge on it.
Wow, fantastic. I remember flip fishing for flathead with Wonder Wobbler when we were a kid. We had a little boat and we're up Foster Way. It was quite a clear, the estuary was quite clear. Must have been down around Harrington, I guess. I was only really little and I was in the boat and Dad was throwing this. We had one lure, I think, the Wonder Wobbler, which casts like a missile. You know, it's so good. You could throw them 100 miles. And he was throwing it up in the sandy patches between the weed beds and you see the flathead come racing out to grab it. It was fantastic because it was very visual. It was really nice, clear water at the front end of the estuary down, I guess it was down towards Harrington. When I think back, I might have been around Foster, but it was just fantastic. Well, really the two lures that we had 50 years ago, 40 years ago or so, were the Wonder Wobbler and the Mr. Twister.
Yep, the Mr. Twister double tail.
The first plastic, plastic ever to be used, and the Wonder Wobbler, you had sort of those spinning lures and all sorts of weird and wonderful stuff that the French made. There was that, I can't remember the name of it. There was one that you could catch a freshwater fish on that had an adjustable bib and it was made out of rubber.
The floppy.
The floppy. The floppy still catch fish? It was pretty cool that it had the adjustable bib. Remember it had the adjustable bib?
Yep, absolutely. Yep. There's a Facebook page I follow that's old collectible lures and the floppy's the holy grail.
Oh, we used to love those, and you could crank the bib down, snap it down, and it'd go deep, or push it up and lock into position. And it was made out of sort of soft rubberized stuff. It was very natural. Like it was a lure before its time. It was so innovative.
Yeah, it was the floppy. I think it was bought out by maybe Mitchell or it was.
No, I think it was originally French design. Rublex.
Yeah.
The Rublex floppy. Yeah. I wonder if anyone's still got one of those in their tackle box. So you're saying they're worth money now?
Yeah, absolutely. They're the holy grail of lure collectors.
Geez, I better go through my tackle box, Craig McGill. I think I might be a millionaire.
look, you know what? The unfortunate thing these days, you go to your old tackle boxes and a lot of those old floppies are just a ball of molten plastic with a bib and a hook on it.
Yeah, the rubber's all melted. Hey, tight lines, mate. Great to talk to you again. And thanks for telling us about your wonderful trip to the Coffs Coast.
No problem, mate. Talk soon.
Craig McGill on The Big Fish.
You get line and I get pole, honey. You get a line and I get a pole today. You get a line and I get a pole. Meet you down at that crawdad hole, honey. You know I mean right. Whoa, honey, you know I'm in red. And I'll catch you on the big fish, baby.
This is The Big Fish with Scott Levi on ABC Radio.
Here comes Stinker with his fishing tips. Some hot advice for your fishing trip. Where to find them? What's the bait?
Are you catching any, mate?
And the headlines in the sporting papers scream, Stinker's back in form. He was in a slump. He's back. Good morning, Stinker.
I'm back. Oh, gee, and it's good to be back on the horse, I can tell you. Because for 2 weeks there, things were looking pretty grim. Slim pickings or very little at all, and trouble with my boat. Now the motor's going perfectly. I motored out to my favourite spot in front of the lighthouse earlier in the week. My granddaughter was coming to visit, and she loves fish. She could eat fish all day. So I've got to have fish in the house when she arrives. So out I went, and I got myself set up. It was bumpy. It was pretty wild out there. And I anchored, and a perfect sit. You know, sometimes, Scott, you just know you're in a good spot. This is where I want to be.
Yeah, but it all lines up. It all lines up.
Everything's lined up. The wind's blowing in the right direction. There's a lovely surge, and there's some good waves and white water. And I had cubed yellowtail for bait and prawns, big king prawns. Anyway, so I set the anchor up, and then I'm just so eager to get a bait in the water because I just felt it in my bones that I was going to catch a good fish. Well, out went the prawn and out went the cubed yellowtail, and I put the rods in the rod holder, and then I'm going to wait. And I waited, but I didn't have to wait long. And then the rod with the prawn, it the line sizzling off and the rod's bent over, and I said, you little beauty. I felt like getting up and dancing in Sting Pot, which is a bit difficult. And then I got him, he's about a 2 kilo snapper, and I thought, well, that's a jolly good start. Well, I ended up with, I ended up catching 8. I could have caught a lot more, but 8 was plenty. So I, when I had 8 beautiful snapper, I thought, that'll do me. And so I was quite happy to head home. But I must tell you, Scott, you know, I told you I hooked a freight train a fortnight ago, a fish that just doesn't stop.
Mm.
And all it's going to do is take all your line. You might have 150, 200 metres of line on you. It doesn't matter. It'll take the whole lot. And you'll end up with a fishing reel with no line on it, and the fish heading off to, well, New Zealand or somewhere. Yeah. Well, the second time in a fortnight, I hooked another freight train.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I was thinking about that last time you spoke about hooking a freight train. And when you're out at sea, even though you're close in to the wash and near the shore, the options are so many more, aren't they? There's so many pelagic fish. I don't know, it could be a marlin, could be any damn thing. Whereas up the estuary, it's probably going to be a dewey. That's about it.
Yeah, that's all pretty right. Anyway, I went and spoke to a young fellow who's a mad fisherman. I've known him since he was a kid, and he just lives his life with fishing. Brent Hancock is his name, and he's a very smart. He knows what's going on. And I was talking to Brent, and I said, I explained to him. I said, 2 weeks ago, I hooked this thing, and it just took off like the last buzz, and I couldn't stop it, and it just kept going and going. And it took a prawn. It took a floating prawn. That was what the bait was. And then when it's taken a heap of line, the pressure and everything, and then, bing, he's gone. okay, that's okay. I just scratch my head and wind the line in. And I noticed that the line has been severed between the swivel and the hook. So that's very strange. I thought, oh, there could have been a little nick there and it could have broken. But that's where it come apart, between the swivel on the trace, between the 20-pound trace, between the swivel and the hook. Okay, that was 2 weeks ago. Well, my recent trip a couple of days ago, exactly the same thing happened. Off it went. And the screaming reel, and I'm just watched the line disappear, and then, bing, it gone again. Okay, wind it in, and I found exactly the same thing.
Ah.
That had been, and that tells a story, doesn't it?
Yes, it's a bit of a Sherlock Holmes job, this, the mystery. Who was the perpetrator?
Well, he said, look, he said, I think I know who's giving you a hard time. And I said, what do you reckon? He said, bronze whale. He said, there's bronze whales around. He said, little ones. He said, they're 6-footers. He said, shark. He said, they'll take anything. They'll eat anything at all. And you won't stop them, not with your gear. And I think, gee, that makes a lot of sense. Because, see, a Jew, a mulloway, or a kingfish, they won't bite you off. You know, they might bust a line or whatever else, or your knots might come apart, but they're not going to chew through your line. So you can eliminate them. You know it's not a snapper, so you can eliminate that. So Brent reckons it's a bronze whale, a shark, and I tell you what, I'm inclined to agree. I think he's dead right.
Yeah, very, very fast, very strong. And you won't get them without wire, and you don't want to get them. Anyway, you don't want to catch them. I got bitten off in the estuary the other day, and I've just worked out what it was. I was fishing a deep hole about 100 foot deep and dropping down a big lead on a 50-pound braid outfit with 80-pound leader and a big piece of fresh squid, you know, wafting there, a big squid, double-hook snooted rig. And I was fishing for mulloway, and I got this thing on, and it fought strange. It went up and down and boom, bit me off. And I couldn't work out what it was. Oh, it might have been a shark, but it didn't take off, you know. And I looked online and I noticed at the fishing website or the Facebook page for that particular estuary I was in, there were hairtail in, and people had been catching hairtail. And I worked it out. They've got the teeth that'll shear through anything. They use wire for them. So that's what I reckon got me. So it's a bit of a detective job sometimes, Stinker.
Oh, that's how it is. You've got to eliminate. Yeah, it's a case of elimination. I've caught one hair tail in my life. One. And it bit me. And I hope I never catch another one.
Oh, they're vicious, aren't they?
Yeah, well, yeah, he certainly sunk his teeth into me. Did you get that photo of the tailor that I sent?
Yeah, that thing is ridiculous, Stinker, and I'll have to put it up online for people to see. That is just looks like a tuna or something. It's so big.
It's a big... They call them jumbo tailor, and it is just a giant of a thing. You'll have to put it up, Scott, because people will want to see it. And I spoke to the bloke who and his crew, and they said there's some really, really big tailor around. When they're talking big tailor, you're talking, everything over 3 kilos is a big tailor, isn't it? But it's an interesting thing. When I first arrived in Nelson Bay 50 years ago, I spoke to a bloke called Gary Morgan. Now, he was born and bred out of One Mile Beach, and he's a mad fisherman, and he still is. And that's a long time. He's been fishing for a long time. And he knows every grain of sand on Stockton Beach, I'm pretty sure. But he told me that the tailor used to be really big. Like, you wouldn't be uncommon to catch tailor up to 7 kilo. And he would catch them in the month of February on the northern rocks on the northern end of Samurai Beach, which is One Mile Beach and then Middle Rock and then Samurai Beach heading towards Single Bay. And he'd sit there and he'd get the big garfish, the real big ones, and he'd have 4-5-0 hooks, and they're pretty solid hooks, and then he'd toss it out and let it slowly, slowly sink in February, and he said he used to regularly catch these great thumping tailor, but he hasn't done that for a long, long time.
Oh, the Guardies used to be great. Great bait for Taylor. That's all we had before the Western Australian pilchards showed up, weren't they?
Yeah, and you could get yellowtail, and you put yellowtail on and throw it out into the surf, you'll catch nothing. They're the worst bait in Australia if you want to catch a tailor, a yellowtail. They're just not, Taylor just weren't interested. You're better off fishing with a spinner, a lure, right? Just cast it out and wobble it or a spinner. That's, you know, I used to call them Toby lures.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Yeah, those Abu Toby.
Wobblers.
Yeah, wobblers, like a big silver slice, yeah.
That's it. And you wind that back as quickly as you can, and, of course, the tailor will always have a crack at that. But I was so pleased to have these beautiful fish in my boat, and so home I went, and the motor's going like a charm. I'm just thinking, no, this is so good. So I got home, and I prepared the fish, and then I said, righto, here you go, this is, and we just ate and ate and ate until we sort of couldn't move, and no, the fish was absolutely fresh snapper filleted and boned, and then you can grill it, just put it on a hot plate with a bit of oil and a mixture of oil and butter. You can do that, or you can pat flour on it and put a bit of flour on it, pepper and salt, or you can make up a cheap batter mix, and that's available at supermarkets, and you got to get it to the right consistency, and then you dip the fish in that and cook it in about 1/4 inch of really hot oil until it gets golden brown. That's what we actually did. But I could have also crumbed it by flour, patting it in flour, and then dipping it in beaten egg, and then into pat it with breadcrumbs, and then into the hot oil, and then golden brown, and then with a squeeze of lemon or a little patch of tartar sauce. Oh dear me,
Stinker, you've got us very hungry, and I will post that picture of your mate holding that tailor. It barely fits in the frame. I mean, it's an absolute beast of a thing. And what was the estimate for its weight?
Well, he asked me from, it's hard to pick the weight of a fish from a picture. But I said, look, I could only go on the mulloway that I used to catch, and I caught far too many of them. And I remember catching mulloway that were around about 13 kilo, and I said, oh, I don't think it was that big, but I'd call it for something like 9 or 10 kilo. And the fisherman, the commercial fisherman, he said, oh, yeah, he said, I'd sort of agree with that. And then I looked up, I researched it, and they're called Jumbo Tailor, and they do exist. And I said, my word, they exist. I've seen it. Fantastic.
Stinker, great that you're back in the saddle again. Tight lines, mate, we'll catch you next time. I can hear you've got a real pep in your step.
Oh, look, I'm back. I feel so good. I was out of form, Scott, but now I'm back in and I've just scored a century.
Right. You kept snicking the slips. Tight lines, mate.
Hooroo.
This is The Big Fish with Scott Levi on ABC Radio.
It's a big fish, and there's nothing like the tidiness after a big day on the river and a few trout under your belt. We're in the central west of New South Wales, and I'm with Peachy, the fly fishing guru. Peachy, what a great day.
We had a terrific day, didn't we, mate? It was lovely to just get out there at the end of the season and find a few trout. Nothing huge, but it doesn't matter. You know, it's still just as much fun catching a, you know, 25-centimetre fish as it is catching a big one, really. It's a, you know, it takes the same skill, doesn't it, to hook a trout, no matter what size it is.
Oh, it's just great fun. And my first ever go at Euro nymphing. I got two, you got four, so six fish all up, all caught on the Euro nymphing or Czech nymphing technique, and I'm hooked. Peachy, you've told me so much about it. You've got to go onto the stream and have a crack, haven't you? It's all good in theory, but until you are in that environment and watching those flies swing down deep without any drag, you don't know what it's about.
Yeah, 100%. You know, I think in this day and age, obviously, you can learn a lot online by watching videos or reading books or any of that sort of stuff. But there's no substitute for actually just getting out there on the water and having somebody show you the techniques firsthand, because it just makes so much more sense when you can see it and when you can have somebody kind of just help you through and maybe give you a couple of pointers of things that you need to do in order to get the right cast and the right drift.
Well, it's a totally different style of casting. It's lob and bob, chuck and duck. It's very different. But because the rod's 10 or 11 feet long, you're getting it out 20 or 30 feet. It's sort of a water haul. It's not a roll cast. That doesn't work. You've just got to... It's totally different to casting a fly line, isn't it?
Very, very different, yeah. And it's especially for, you know, if people have been casting a fly line for a long time, it's a bit of an adjustment. I think the main thing that people really struggle with is trying to direct the fly to where they want it to go, because the fly with a fly line, you can sort of direct the rod where you want the cast to go and the fly will follow. But with this, you've got no mass in the line at all. You've just got all the mass in the tungsten bead and the fly on the end. So you can make a cast in a particular direction, but the fly is going to go 180 degrees from where it was in the other direction from the rod tip. And that really, really throws people for a while a lot of the time.
Yeah, once you get the hang of it, though, and there are great ways to modify the depth that the fly fishes in, and we're fishing really fast water. The fish were in really deep, fast water, and you'd either have the rod angled low and sweep it. You've got to move the rod and the line at the same pace as the river. It's a very natural way to present flies, and you can modify how deep it is in the column by lifting the rod. That was great, and I got one fish. The first fish, I don't know how I caught it. It got on by itself. But I got one fish where I was drifting through a really deep run between two rocks. And I thought, I want to see how deep that fly is. So I kept lifting and lifting. And it's a very long rod, you know, 11-foot rod, lifting and lifting. And this rainbow trout rocketed out of the depth and took it like an emerging nymph and just grabbed it. So that was really thrilling to see it do that. You catch them on the swing, you catch them on the rise.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you've got a lot of control with a Euro-nymphing rig of that sort of swing section of the presentation. You can really bring the flies up very slowly and very vertically through the column in a way that I think probably looks a lot more natural to the trout than when you say swinging flies on a floating fly line or something like that, where you've got the current kicking around the line everywhere and the flies are swinging sideways across the current, which is probably not, doesn't look very natural to a trout. But I think when a fly comes up vertically in the current, it does look quite natural to them. It looks like an emerging insect.
And the flies would have to be the simplest fly you could ever tie. Just get some tungsten beads in silver and gold, and that's it, really. Whatever you want to put on there, but you use a little bit of citer, pink or orange.
Yeah, so you can do all kinds of different nymphs for Euro nymphs. Sometimes you might want very small, very natural, drab-looking things that look like a little midge or a mayfly emerge or something like that. But other times, you know, the fish will bite sort of bright attractor-style flies like we were fishing today with, you know, bright pink and things on them that you think, oh, God, that doesn't look the slightest bit like anything that's actually in the river.
I like the way you incorporated a traditional wee wet fibre hackle. I don't know, what, a bit of partridge or something? I don't know what it was.
Yeah, a little bit of partridge. Yep, you can do all of that. You can fish unhackled flies. You can fish soft hackled flies like that sort of pulse a little bit in the current and give it a little bit more movement. Yeah, you've got lots of options. The one thing that is really the key element that has to be on every Euro nymphing fly pretty much is a tungsten bead, because you need that weight.
You need it to get down. What it's like, and the deadliest trout fishermen I've ever seen were the old codgers, like my dear old man, and a few of the old blokes in the bush who had long, long, soft fiberglass rods. and all they'd use is a size 10 hook and a great big scrub worm, and they'd flip it up and it'd go straight down because there's no, they wouldn't use any lead, and it would come down through the run, particularly if there was some colour in the river, and they would just catch every fish in the river. It's sort of like that. In a lot of ways, it's the sporting fly fishing version of that.
Yeah, it is. Look, I mean, there is a fly that we use that I suppose looks a little bit like something like that that we call the mop. There are, you know, a couple of flies that are colloquially known as junk flies. One of them is a worm, a squirmy worm, and the other one is a mop, which is literally a little bit, one of the shaggy bits off the end of a mop that you buy at Bunnings.
The scouring like pads, I think.
And you put a bead on the front of that and a little bit of dubbing on it, and it looks quite a lot like sort of a crane fly larva or a maggot or something like that. And it's, you know, after a bit of rain, when the river's up a bit, it can be a deadly effective fly.
Yeah, the mop fly, but it's all about that little tungsten bead, something really small that looks, and they're so heavy and they get down so quickly, that looks very much like around the same size as an aquatic nymph. Yep. And there were a few mayflies popping off today. What a gorgeous day it's been. I mean, we're heading home now and heading back onto the highway, but just fantastic, beautiful weather. It was about 4 degrees when we got down to the river, and the fish were hard to get. We had to winkle them out of the fast water, but that's what urinymphing is all about, isn't it? They weren't rising, they weren't moving. We were going and finding them in their little lairs deep in the fast runs, where normally you wouldn't get them with conventional fly gear.
Yeah, that's right. And I think especially, you know, very early and very late in the season like this, when the water's cold, you're not generally going to see too many rising fish. Sometimes they might start rising if there's a bit of a hatch, but generally speaking, you're going to want to catch them on nymphs, and you're going to want to get down deep a little bit like that. And it was a gorgeous day today. So pleasant to be out there fishing when it's not too hot outside, and you can go out and comfortably fish on a day like this, and, you know, gentlemen's hours, and have some great fishing. I love the early and late season. It's a really nice time to fish.
It's not an expensive form of fly fishing either, euro nymphing, because you don't need a fly line. My rig is some fluorescent 14-pound game line, because it was pink, bright pink, a couple of metres of 12-pound mono, then some sighter leader, which is all different coloured tricolour, then a tippet ring, and then down to some 6X 3-pound tippet. So there's no fly line, and a good fly line these days costs you a fortune.
Yeah, that's right. I think probably, you can go out and euro nymph like that on, even on just a conventional dry fly rod. I think if you want to give it a proper go, though, probably the most important element in euro nymphing is probably the rod itself.
Yeah, they're very long, they're very whippy, they're quite different.
Yeah, and they're quite soft as well, so they give you good tippet protection for the very fine tippet that you need to use. Mm. So having a dedicated euro nymphing rod, I think, does make a big difference. But apart from that, any fly fishing reel pretty much will do the trick. And as you said, you just need some mono and a bit of cider material, some tippet rings, some fluorocarbon tippet, and some tungsten beaded flies, and away you go. It doesn't have to be complicated.
Well, it was great to learn something, an old dog like me, to learn a new technique. And I'm looking forward to taking it down to Tasmania at the start of the season. Down there, there's some nice, deep, fast runs that hold some huge browns and rainbows. And they're hard to get to with conventional tackle, but urinymphing is the go. And you're off to Norway to represent Australia in the Masters, is it?
Yeah, the World Masters, which should be fun. We're going to be fishing for grayling, which is a new thing for me. And I imagine we'll be doing quite a lot of nymphing over there as well. But I'm sure you'll have a terrific time in Tassie
The nymph rod. We can compare notes when you get back and when I get back. And good luck representing the country. Do us proud.
Thanks, mate. Good on you. Good luck in Tassie.
Steve Peachy Peach there on the river.
It's on the Big Fish Show. You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.